Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, September 20th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's look at today's weather forecast, and then we'll go right to sports. This weather forecast is coming from KCRG-TV. Hannah Messier has titled the forecast, "Clouds with isolated to scattered showers and storms are possible on Wednesday." We had scattered showers and storms move through the region early last night, but all that's left behind this morning are isolated showers and a partly cloudy sky. For today and Thursday, temperatures this morning are in the 60s across most of the region. An isolated shower or two will be possible throughout the day. However, most of the area will stay dry with more clouds than sun. Highs will climb into the upper 70s and low 80s. Thursday's forecast looks dry with highs reaching the 90s. On Friday and beyond, after today, our next chance for showers and storms is on Friday and through the beginning of next week as low-pressure system meanders through the region. More than an inch of rainfall is possible over most of eastern Iowa. There is also a chance that some of the storms on Saturday could become strong to severe. Make sure to check back for updates to the forecast. Highs for Friday and through next week will stay in the 70s. And now in sports, college football, Lakey injury, an unfortunate situation for Iowa. Dateline Iowa City. An injury forced junior tight end Luke Lakey out of the Hawkeyes' win over the Western Michigan in the first quarter on Saturday. On Tuesday, Iowa head coach Kurt Ferentz provided an update on Lakey's injury and said it was most likely a season-ending injury. Quote, "I feel most badly for him," Ferentz said. "He is the person most affected. Just an unfortunate development. But he will be fine here in time. But it is a significant injury, so he's going to be out for quite a while," unquote. Ferentz noted that Lakey underwent surgery on the injury on Tuesday. Lakey proved to be Iowa's most reliable option in the passing game through the first 2 weeks of the season. The junior tight end followed a 28-reception, 398-yard season, during which he led Iowa with 4 receiving touchdowns in 2022 by becoming quarterback Cade McNamara's safety blanket. The former Michigan transfer looked Lakey's way 16 times in Iowa's wins over Utah State and Iowa State to begin the 2023 season. The Columbus, Ohio product responded with 10 receptions for 131 yards. Though he did not find the end zone, Lakey led the Hawkeyes in catches and yards through 2 weeks. And here we have a photograph of the injury on the field, and the caption says, "Iowa tight end Luke Lakey lies injured on the field against Western Michigan on Saturday, September 16, 2023, at Kinnick Stadium in Iowa City." Lakey left Iowa's Week 3 contest with an apparent lower body injury after McNamara looked his way on a third down pass attempt, Lakey's first and only target of the game. He did not return to action and was seen on the sidelines sporting a walking boot on his right foot. Following the game, McNamara discussed Lakey's injury. Quote, "We do not know what it exactly is yet," McNamara said on Saturday. "But when one of your brothers goes down like that, it is horrible to see. We are all going to be praying for him, and it is just tough to see your boy do that," unquote. During the Hawkeyes' weekly media availability, junior wide receiver Deontay Vines, who missed the first 6 games of the 2022 season with a wrist injury, said he reached out to Lakey after the game. According to Vines, he expects big things from Lakey once he returns to action. Quote, "I texted Luke after," Vine said. "I told him he is going to have the biggest comeback, the greatest comeback story that they will talk about forever. It is going to be a legendary comeback for Luke. I already know it. When he comes back, he is still going to be the same person. Quote, I cannot give him too many wise words on it. I just know that he has to keep his head. I know he is going to keep his head. I know he loves this game so much that he is going to come back to it and be as dominant as ever, unquote. Although Vines expects the biggest comeback for Lakey, it is undecided whether that comeback will be with the Hawkeyes. With 46 receptions, 662 yards, and 4 touchdowns in 30 games, 13 starts, across 4 seasons in Iowa, Lakey could look to focus his return from injury on preparing for the NFL draft and pre-draft process. Green Bay Packers rookie Luke Musgrave, who has similar measurable to Lakey, was selected in the second round of the 2023 NFL draft with similar college production to Lakey. Until Lakey makes a decision on his future, Vines said that he expects to still see plenty of Lakey around the program. Quote, he will be back in the building smiling, cheering us on, and still be the great leader that he is, Vines said. After Lakey exited Saturday's win, senior tight ends Steven Stellanos and Eric all filled in admirably. All led Iowa with 1 reception for 34 yards, while Stellanos snared 2 passes for 29 yards to finish 2nd in receiving yards to all. The play of Lakey's replacements served as 1 positive, according to Ferentz, in an overall unfortunate situation. Quote, the tight ends, as a group, stepped up and did a good job, Ferentz said. Quote, Eric obviously is a quality player, and Addison Ostrenga is a good young player coming up the ladder. Stylianos, we have talked about him, a much improved player in the spring and camp, and he did a good job too, unquote. In Lakey's absence, Vines described the Hawkeyes' offense as next man up and said it starts with Iowa's next game against number 7 Penn State. Quote, it's hard losing Luke, Vines said. Quote, that is a great tight end for us. Great player, great leader. It is sad to see him get injured. We are going to miss him, but the receivers, we know we have to step up. Quote, it is an opportunity for us to go out there and make names for ourselves against a great defense, unquote. The Nittany Lions rank 16th in the nation through 3 weeks, allowing just 267.3 yards per game. In terms of scoring, Penn State has allowed just 11.67 points per game in the first 3 weeks, ranking 13th in scoring defense. Next, dynamic display of area talent. Future Division I athletes show off their abilities. Story written by Ethan Petrick. Dateline Sumner. Iowa State sits at number 23 in the American Volleyball Coaches Association Top 25. Northern Iowa entered the 2023 season off a Missouri Valley Conference title in 2022. Iowa owns a 6-4 record after going toe-to-toe with the Cyclones last week. However, on Tuesday of last week, the greatest collection of volleyball talent in Iowa may have been in the gymnasium at Sumner Fredericksburg High School, the number 4. Sumner Fredericksburg Cougars hosted the number 3 Grundy Center Spartans and number 1 Dyke New Hartford Wolverines in a class of 2A heavyweights. Quote, Northeast Iowa volleyball is pretty incredible, Sumner Fredericksburg head coach Sarah Booman said. A lot of good volleyball players are from this area. It's exciting, unquote. It was the exact level of competition Booman wants her Cougars to be facing. Quote, we want to be playing good competition, Booman said. We are basically halfway at this point, and we want to play the good teams. We want to play the Grundy Centers. We want to play the Dyke New Hartfords. We want to play ranked teams because it's going to make us better. Hopefully, in the postseason, it's going to pay off, unquote. But just how good were these 3 teams facing off in Sumner? A combined 43-6 entering the triangular, the teams represent 3 of the 11 ranked teams that make up the North Iowa Cedar League, NICL, Dyke, New Hampshire, and Sumner Fredericksburg advanced to state, and Grundy Center fell one game shy of state in a regional final against Denver, another Cedar Valley program. In 2023, the Cougars, Wolverines, and Spartans are a combined 6-0 against 5A competition, 3-1 against 4A competition, and 6-4 against 3A competition. In other words, this trio is the battle-tested, tried-and-true cream of the crop, not just in 2A, in the state. Quote, "It is the best volleyball in the state of Iowa by far," Grundy Center's Carly Willis said. Quote, "Every year you go to the state tournament, and all of these teams are there back-to-back. There is not really an off year for the NICL. They are good every single year," unquote. The teams also featured 6 seniors with collegiate volleyball plans, including 3 UNI commits. The Wolverines brought 3 with Jaden Peterson, UNI, Marin Bixby, UNI, and Peyton Peterson, Louisville. Grundy Center offered 2 more in Willis, St. Cloud State, and Ellery Luring, Northwest Missouri State. Isabel Elliott, UNI, represented the hosts. Quote, "We are a bunch of small-town girls with big dreams," Elliott said. "We all work hard and compete. It's just so fun," unquote. Beyond the headlines, each school brought teams with the necessary depth for a worthy night of volleyball. The Cougars, Spartans, and Wolverines treated those lucky enough, smart enough, to attend the triangular, to exceptional volleyball. Points lasting upwards of a minute with 10 different attack attempts proved the norm as diving play after thunderous kill was executed flawlessly. Dyke New Hartford managed to remain unbeaten, taking both matches against the Spartans and Cougars. In a true show of strength, the 2022 2A runners-up and 2020 and 2021 champions won both matches via sweep, never winning by less than 8 points. Grundy Center edged out the Cougars in a 3-set match, which saw Sumner Fredericksburg take the first game 25-18, before the Spartans rallied with wins of 25-20 and 17-15. Although the hosting Cougars failed to earn a win on the night, Elliott described the triangular as a both an enjoyable and valuable experience for Sumner Fredericksburg. Quote, "It is awesome. I'd love to just go out and compete," Elliott said. Quote, "Playing at a high level in the long run, once you get to postseason, it helps us. I would not have it any other way. Competing against such a high level, I feel blessed that I can do that." Quote, "It gives us a little preview almost. It drives us. We want to go out there again and compete," unquote. She added that a lot can be learned from facing the top players in the area, even for the 2022 statewide kills leader. Quote, "When Jaden rolled a couple on me there," Elliott said, "I am like, okay, I'm going to try and do it back. It pushes you to go back and swing harder," unquote. Facing a number of her 6-pack volleyball club teammates, including 2 of her future college teammates in Bixby and Jaden Peterson, Elliott added that the group does not talk smack and instead encourages each other. For Grundy Center, Luring and Willis both agreed the challenge of facing 2 top 5 teams in the same game helped them get better. Quote, "It is tough, but I think it helps us become a better team," Luring said. "Seeing that competition is really good for us and just really pushes us and is going to help us in postseason play." Quote, "It kind of gives me goosebumps," Willis said. "We know all of these girls, too. All of these girls are great humans, too. So it is really fun. We are blessed in this part of the state. It makes my job easier to have that kind of talent." Fun, a common refrain on Tuesday night. The Sumner-Fredericksburg Triangular, featuring Dyke New Hartford and Grundy Center, was fun. Let's do it again. Now in college women's volleyball, UNI sweeps NIU, goes 2-1, Dateline Cedar Falls. Northern Iowa swept Northern Illinois in the final match of its home volleyball tournament on Saturday. The Panthers rolled the Huskies 25-11, 25-17, and 25-19. In the first set, UNI jumped out to a 6-0 lead before NIU managed to score its first point of the contest. UNI cruised to a win from there, outscoring the Huskies 19-10 the rest of the way. NIU kept it close through the early goings of the second set, trailing just 8-6 after 14 points. UNI jumped out to the 6-point lead 15-9 with a 5-2 surge. The Panthers cruised to another win from there. Despite leading by as much as 7 points, UNI fell behind briefly in the third set, 18-17. The Panthers closed on an 8-1 run, however, to seal the match victory. Kira Fallert led UNI with 15 kills, Leanna Green recorded 12, and Emily Holterhouse added 11. Taylor Alden dished 38 assists in the win. Aaron Powers notched 14 digs, while Fallert recorded 10. With the win, UNI improved to 6-6 on the season and 2-1 at home. The Panthers begin Missouri Valley Conference play on Friday against Bradley and Peoria at 6 p.m. Again, that's Friday evening at 6 p.m. We have the weekly crop report from the United States Department of Agriculture. Dateline Des Moines. The southern tier of Iowa received above-average rainfall during the week ending Sunday, but the state's northeast corner continued to experience unseasonable dryness. The weather led to 6.1 days suitable for field work statewide, according to the United States Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service. The outlook may change, though, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig said in comments about the weekly Iowa Crop Progress and Condition Report. Quote, with harvest ramping up in parts of Iowa, weather outlooks are hitting at warmer temperatures and getting greater chances of rain into early October, unquote. Quote, it's National Farm Safety and Health Week, and throughout the harvest, I encourage all Iowans to keep safety in the field and on the road top of mind, unquote. Field activities during the past week included harvesting corn and soybeans. Some farmers were also working on their fourth cutting of alfalfa hay. Topsoil moisture condition rated 34% very short, 45% short, 20% adequate, and 1% surplus. Subsoil moisture conditions rated 37% very short, 47% short, and 19% adequate, and 1% surplus. Okay, here's a funny one. Bears raid a Krispy Kreme donut van making deliveries on an Alaska military base. That's right, it's bears. This came from the Associated Press. Joint Base Almendorf, Richardson, Alaska. Two bears on an Alaska military base raided a Krispy Kreme donut van that was stopped outside a convenience store during its delivery route. The driver usually left his doors open when he stopped at the store, but this time, a sow and one of her cubs that loitered nearby sauntered inside, where they stayed for probably 20 minutes Tuesday morning, said Shelley Diano, the store manager for Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson JMM Express. The bears chomped on donut holes and other pastries, ignoring the banging on the side of the van that was aimed at shooing them away, Diano said. And here we have a photograph of the inside of that van with the doors open and you can see two bears just having a great time knocking down trays of donuts. Quote, I was beating on the van and they're not moving. I could hear them breaking open the packages and everything, she said. I was like, they don't even care, unquote. When the bears couldn't be roused, base security was called and sounded sirens meant to scare away the bears, she said. The bears eventually came out and wandered in front of the convenience store and gas station a bit before heading into the woods. It's not unusual to see bears on base or around the store, but nothing like this has happened before, Diano said, adding that the delivery driver now closes his doors when he stops at the shop. Quote, we're cautious when we come in, when we leave, when we take out garbage. We do it in pairs, especially if it's dark, she said. Captain Lexi Smith, a spokesperson at the base, said authorities on base, quote, are aware of this and other wildlife situations throughout the past several months. Quote, we urge the public to use caution to ensure you are protecting our wildlife and yourselves. Wildlife may be our neighbor, but they should not be attracted to our human food sources, she said by email. Now, in the Courier's top story, Hidden Gem on University of Northern Iowa campus celebrates 50 years. Dateline Cedar Falls. Just a few blocks from the center of the University of Northern Iowa campus, people can venture into 8 acres of native prairie. Darrell Smith Prairie is located right off of University Avenue at 720 West 29th Street. Although somewhat hidden, the prairie has been there for 50 years, and here we're treated to a photograph of two young girls with butterfly nets, and the caption says, Emily and Jackie Rumsey try to catch grasshoppers at the University of Northern Iowa's 50th anniversary event, celebrating the Darrell Smith Prairie on Saturday. The UNI Department of Biology and the Tallgrass Prairie Center celebrated the anniversary on Saturday. The prairie is home to about 100 plant species, as well as a number of insects, birds, and mammals. The Darrell Smith Prairie was the beginning of UNI's biological preserves system, which is more than 80 acres of prairie, forest, and woodlands. Laura Jackson, director of the Tallgrass Prairie Center, said UNI is unique for how many natural areas are on campus. She called Darrell Smith Prairie the jewel in the crown of its finest and most distinctive assets. The preserves are along Dry Run Creek and have 5.8 miles of trails, which are open to the public. Quote, like many good things, it can be easy to take for granted, Jackson said. Today's the day to celebrate it, recognize it, and look forward to the next 50 years, unquote. The nearly 70 attendees had the chance to try out the new campus trail system, watch migrating monarchs, identifying native plants, and catch insects. One family, the Rumseys, took to the field to try to catch bugs. If a bug were caught, they would take it back to an entomologist who would identify it. The Rumsey children, Emily, age 4, and Jackie, age 6, swatted at plants to catch bugs in their nets. They were looking for grasshoppers in particular. Their parents, Shapina and Brian, who both teach at UNI, said they had lived in the area for 7 years and didn't know the prairie existed. Quote, I love that it's accessible to the community to come to, Shapina Rumsey said. It's a real gift to have something like this close to town, but you're still right here in the prairie, unquote. The prairie was first seeded by Darrell Smith and a couple of other people at the college with only 6 species of grass. Over the years, the diversity of plants has increased. Smith, who was present at the event and sitting at a booth with old newspaper clippings and pamphlets, said he had hoped the prairie would last this long, but joked he wasn't thinking 50 years into the future. Smith became interested in prairie restoration while earning his master's degree at the University of South Dakota and his doctorate degree at the University of Iowa. He started teaching at UNI in 1967. Throughout his tenure, Smith taught more than 30 different courses in science and science education and was the head of the biology department for 7 years. He founded the Tallgrass Prairie Center in 1999, then called the Native Roadside Vegetation Center, and was its director for 11 years. Smith said prior to the UNI Prairie's establishment, he would take students out to the Cedar Hills Sand Prairie. The 36-acre preserve was located 10 miles northwest of Cedar Falls, south of Fitchford, wishing for similar habitats on campus so he didn't have to haul students to the Sand Prairie. He took matters into his own hands. Along with a prairie, he helped create what is now the Upland Forest Area, which is located on the edge of the prairie. The 35-acre preserve was established in 1981 by planting thousands of acorns and transplanting tree saplings. The forest has the highest elevation in the preserve system and is home to UNI's observatory. UNI students helped burn the prairie every spring and use it as an outdoor laboratory for many ecology classes. Mallory Sage, a Green Iowa AmeriCorps member who works at the Tallgrass Prairie Center, has been looking into the future of the prairie. She wants to make the Darrell Smith Prairie more known to the public by putting in signage that sets the tone for the experience. Quote, "It's a hidden gem," she said. County's landfill to create and sell renewable natural gas. Story filed by Maria Cooper. Dateline Waterloo. A new wave of technology is being implemented at the county landfill to create renewable energy. The Blackhawk County Solid Waste Management Commission is installing a gas collection system at the landfill located at 1509 East Washburn Road. It will collect methane produced by waste to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Greenhouse gases are defined as gases in the atmosphere that raise the surface temperature of the planet. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, municipal solid waste landfills are the third largest source of human-related methane emissions in the U.S. This is the equivalent to greenhouse gas emissions from more than 23 million gasoline-powered passenger vehicles driven for 1 year, or the carbon dioxide emissions for more than 13 million homes energy use for 1 year. Landfill gas can be captured and turned into a renewable energy resource instead of being released into the air, which contributes to climate change. Landfill gas projects can also generate revenue. And here we have a photograph of a worker digging and landing pipe at the side of a hill, and we can see some of the pipe laid aside there, and at the top of the hill is a Caterpillar excavator. Construction for the project at the landfill began in June and is expected to be done before May 2024. Solid Waste Administrator John Foster said the landfill accepts 190,000 tons of waste a year. With the new gas system, he said, 3,613 tons of methane will be reduced annually, which is the equivalent to heating 2,569 homes a year. Selling that renewable gas will bring an estimated $70,000 of revenue within the first year of implementation. The Waste Management Commission entered into a landfill gas rights agreement with Pine Creek RNG, based in St. Petersburg, Florida, last year. The company builds, owns, and operates landfill and digester methane capture plants, as well as other waste-to-energy infrastructure facilities. They are active in 8 states. Kevin Orchard, Pine Creek RNG's vice president, contacted Foster because the Blackhawk County site met the criteria and characteristics of a viable site. The company bases its partnerships on the amount of methane produced by a landfill and the amount of waste produced. Orchard said similar landfills usually don't have enough waste to process, which doesn't make economical sense. He said the company is looking at other sites in eastern Iowa to work with, but could not disclose the locations. The great thing is, according to Foster, the county is not paying a penny for the construction of the project, but it is fully owned by the commission. Orchard wouldn't disclose the exact cost of the project, but said it is around $25 million. In the end, there is value for everyone involved. Quote, "Our investors will get return on the project. The landfill will get economic return. The community benefits through lower emission, and it's producing a renewable fuel product that goes to the market to offset reliance," Orchard said. Quote, "There's certainly risk in this project, but once they're up and running, it will provide benefits to everyone involved. The landfill also benefits by getting ahead of the game in implementing a gas collection system, according to Foster. Currently, the Blackhawk County landfill is not required to have one, but Foster believes within 15 years it will. Under the Clean Air Act, landfills are required to track the amount of waste and the emissions it creates. Once a landfill hits a specific amount, it is required to put in a gas collection system. Foster said the county landfill is at about one-third of that limit. Organic waste, such as food, clothing, paper products, creates the gas. Non-organic products like plastic do not. Once the trash is dumped into the landfill, it will have oxygen in it for about a week. When more waste is put on top of it and dirt is piled up, it will get rid of the oxygen, creating anaerobic microbes that emit methane. Methane is a renewable natural gas that can be used in many ways. For example, California has a goal of eliminating all diesel trucks by 2036, and methane is an alternative fuel to power those trucks. Other companies can produce the gas to offset their carbon footprint. Quote, failure to use this gas would be a wasted resource, Orchard said. The gas collection system works like this. The landfill's solid waste creates gas, which is extracted through wells and piping. Gas is then sent to a primary processing system and then to the on-site plant to be cleaned and injected into a pipeline. Foster said the site already has a pipeline on the property and a plant also is being constructed. There are 55 wells being built into the ground that go 60 to 120 feet deep. There will be local effects as well. Foster said it will help the landfill avoid future regulatory costs, as well as help support climate action plans put in place by Cedar Falls and Waterloo by reducing one of the county's largest emitters of greenhouse gas. Waterloo's Ward 2 council member, Jonathan Grider, has been a proponent of putting plans in place to reduce effects of climate change. He is excited for the project. Quote, I see this as a win-win, with scenario for everyone, Grider said. He said it makes an environmental difference, helps the area transition toward clean energy, and will create revenue from selling the energy, while at the same time allowing other people to use it. Quote, it's really good that partnerships in the Cedar Valley are working toward common goals for the environment, he continued. It also helps build that momentum that there are things local governments can do, that they should do, that are very impactful, and build momentum to build on other projects of that magnitude, unquote. And now, listeners, we'd just like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, September 20th, on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. Now, this announcement.
If you're struggling with your mental health, there's something Your Life Iowa wants you to know. It's all right to feel sad, to be angry, to feel depressed, to be anxious, to feel lonely. Something else that's definitely all right? Getting help for your mental health. When you're ready, Your Life Iowa is here for you 24/7. Find support at yourlifeiowa.org. Together, we can make everything all right. Brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
And now let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial today comes from the New York Times titled Wonking Out, Time, Memory, and Inflation, and was written by Paul Krugman. Almost all the available evidence suggests that the U.S. economy is achieving what many economists had thought impossible, a soft landing, in which inflation returns to acceptable levels without a recession. Yet polls suggest that the public remains very down on the state of the economy. Why? I and others have been arguing that there's a big gap between people's personal experience and what they say about what's happening to, quote, the economy, that is, other people. Surveys aside, consumer spending on discretionary items like travel remains strong, suggesting that people are feeling pretty good about their own situation, even as they say the economy is in the dumps. Some commentators, however, are strenuously, I might even say weirdly, opposed to considering this possibility, which I find hard to understand. After all, we know that views about the state of the economy are marked by huge partisan differences. This in itself tells us that what people say about the economy is to an important extent driven by what they see on TV and what they think they should say. However, when it comes to one important issue, inflation, I think there's a way to look at the situation that makes sense of the divergence between economists, who are almost giddy over the speed with which inflation has come down, and the broader public, which still says that inflation is getting worse. If I'm right, a lot of it has to do with time, specifically how far back people look when thinking about inflation. News reports often lead with inflation over the past year. There are reasons to focus on one-year rates of change. They help smooth out noisy monthly data, and you don't have to worry about seasonal effects. And in the past, the one-year inflation rate was probably, as my father used to say, good enough for government work. At this point, however, I'm pretty sure that most working economists consider a year to be too long a lag. The inflation situation is changing rapidly, probably because we are finally working out the supply kinks caused by the pandemic. If we look at core inflation, which excludes volatile food and energy prices, the one-year inflation rate is still unacceptably high. But over the past 3 months, inflation has run at only 2.4%. And even this number partly reflects delayed effects of a shelter price surge that ended many months ago. It might be a few months before we're willing to declare victory in the war on inflation, but we won't need a run of improving data. If the next few months look like the past few, we'll basically be there. Yet, 74% of voters say that inflation is getting worse, not better. Partisanship colors these numbers. 92% of Republican primary voters say that inflation is going up. But it probably isn't all partisanship and misinformation. Instead, I'd suggest it's largely about how everyday people think about inflation. Some commentators have argued that when you say inflation, ordinary people think about the level of prices, not the rate of change. That would be very bad news if true. We haven't had actual deflation, falling prices, since the 1930s. So if people won't be happy unless prices go back to where they were a long time ago, it would take a depression to satisfy them. But I'd argue that it's not really about levels as opposed to rates of change. How many people are upset that you can't get McDonald's hamburgers for 15 cents, which is what they cost in the chain's early days? Also consider the last time we saw a big drop in inflation during the Reagan years. Overall prices continued to rise. In fact, inflation stabilized at around 4%, much higher than what we have now. Yet, as this 1984 poll suggests, voters nonetheless gave Reagan credit for reducing inflation, credit that actually belonged to Paul Volcker, but that's another story. So here's an alternative hypothesis. Voters assess inflation by comparing current prices with what they remember paying in the past, where the relevant past may be several years ago. Put it this way, when we try to assess macroeconomic trends, we look at inflation over a relatively short period, say 3 months. But to predict consumer perceptions, we want to look at a much longer period, say 3 years. Now, I don't know whether 3 years is the right number, but let's run with it for a minute. What you can see is that at the time of that 1984 poll, 3-year inflation had indeed declined substantially. Right now, by contrast, despite a rapid decline in 1-year inflation, 3-year inflation is barely off its peak. Why the difference? the Reagan era disinflation came after years of high inflation, so when inflation finally began coming down, it did so at all the time horizons. This time, however, we had years of low inflation, then a sudden surge in short-term inflation in 2021-22, which is still filtering into longer-term averages, even though short-term inflation has come back down. Or to be less formulaic, arguably right now, Americans' notions of what things should cost largely reflects prices before the big 2021-22 run-up, so they don't perceive any improvement in inflation yet. But I'd argue that there are good reasons to expect those perceptions to improve. Over time, memories of prices from, say, 2020 will fade or come to seem less salient, while the relatively low inflation we're experiencing now will loom larger in public perceptions. Suppose, to be excessively specific, we assume that future inflation proceeds at 2.4%, the core rate over the past 3 months. What would that mean for the 3-year rate of inflation? The answer is that it would gradually decline over the months ahead. If some people have a shorter time horizon, say 2 years, perceived inflation will decline even faster. All of this has obvious political implications. Current polling says that Americans give Donald Trump an edge over Joe Biden in handling the economy, which is unfair but understandable. After all, Biden presided over a big bulge in inflation, while Trump didn't, and the huge improvement in the inflation picture is too recent to have filtered into public perceptions. If anything, I'm surprised that the gap in perceived economic competence isn't bigger. But the election is more than a year away, so there's still time for memories of lower prices to fade and for the reality of sharper, lower inflation to sink in with the public. I doubt that the economy will be a source of political strength for Democrats, but it may well be much less of a drag than many people imagine. This next column was printed in the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, and it's by guest columnist Steve Corbin, titled "Conservative Attack on the First Amendment." I fondly recall my senior year in high school when Mary Beth Tinker, John Tinker, and Christopher Eckhart wore black armbands to their high school to protest the Vietnam War. Their suspension from school was cast around the thought that wearing armbands would disrupt learning. In a landmark Supreme Court case, Tinker versus Des Moines, in 1969, justices agreed students' rights should be protected, and they refuted the school's stance by candidly stating, quote, "Students don't shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gates," unquote. Many of today's GOP-oriented governors and legislators, far right-wing groups, conservative media, and Republican presidential candidates have either passed or supported book banning, anti-LGBTQIA, and anti-racist curriculum laws. It's a blatant attack on the constitutional rights of students, parents, teachers, the general public, and authors. Several organizations and politicians, identified by a multitude of sources, are named as a threat to Americans' intellectual freedom and First Amendment rights. Moms for Liberty may be the most cited right-wing extremist group. Founded in 2021, MFL is referred by the Southern Poverty Law Center as an anti-government and conspiracy propagandist group of 120,000 members in 285 chapters throughout 44 states who, among many beliefs, are anti-LGBTQIA, anti-gender identity, and anti-inclusive educational curriculum, which includes school pedagogy, social-emotional learning, and books. MFL has been featured on The Rush Limbaugh Show, Fox News' Tucker Carlson Tonight, Glenn Beck's program, Newsmax, and Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly's show. MFL is associated with several chapters of the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, Gays Against Groomers, and the GOP-affiliated Heritage Foundation. It's quite ironic MFL tout its is for liberty, yet it is willing to strip others of their liberty to read books of interest. The American Library Association reveals of the 2,571 book titles banned for censorship in 2022, 58% were targeted for schools and 41% were aimed at adults in public libraries. Hence, the organization is not only attacking students' First Amendment rights, but also 78% of Americans who are adults. No Left Turn in Education, NLTIE, urges parents to ban LGBTQIA rights books categorized as anti-racism, anti-police, critical race theory, and comprehensive sexuality education, since those concepts don't align with its autocratic agenda. Nicole Neely, president of Parents Defending Education, has been described as a, quote, veteran political operative affiliated with the Koch Network. PDE is a group of corporate school privatizers going hard right to attack school boards, superintendents, principals, and teachers, according to Media Matters. According to the American Liberty Association's Intellectual Freedom blog, No Left Turn in Education, PDE, and Moms for Liberty share inflammatory claims about radical agendas to disguise their desire to engage in censorship and government control of intellectual freedom. Book banning narrows students' cultural understanding, worldview, and critical thinking capability. Finally, there's the Goldwater Institute, which proudly states that its aims are to control public schools' K-12 curriculum. Individuals who are cited by multiple sources to be in concert with MFL, NLTIE, PDE, and GI include former President Donald Trump, former UN Ambassador and Governor Nikki Haley, Republican from South Carolina, former Governor Asa Hutchinson, Republican from Arkansas, Governor Ron DeSantis from Florida, Governor Kim Reynolds, Republican in Iowa, Governor Glenn Youngkin, Republican from Virginia, Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, Senator Rick Scott, Republican in Florida, Senator Josh Hawley, a Republican from Missouri, Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from Georgia, and GOP presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy of Ohio. America was founded on the value and importance of free expression. According to John Stuart Mill's essay, quote, On Liberty, in 1859, free speech must be protected from political, economic, and social tyranny. When our First Amendment rights are purposely being attacked by right-wing extremists, they are attempting to shackle the minds of children and adults, plus America's future. Bottom line is, we are witnessing politicians and groups who want America to abandon its 1630s New England colonies' democratic roots and become an authoritarian country like Russia, China, and North Korea. Quote, Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves, unquote. And that's from Matthew chapter 7, verse 15. The author here is Steve Corbin, and he is an emeritus professor of marketing at the University of Northern Iowa. This last piece comes from Paul Krugman at the New York Times, The Road from Mitt Romney to MAGA. So Mitt Romney is retiring from the Senate. This is bad news. As excerpts from a forthcoming biography reveal, Romney is clear-eyed about what has happened to his party and, if what he says is true, is a profile in courage compared with colleagues who share his horror but are unwilling to say anything. Yet some of the commentary I've seen about Romney comes close to hagiography, which he doesn't deserve. It's good to see Romney speaking up now, but the party he's criticizing is in large part a monster that people like him helped create. For the basic story of the Republican Party, going back to the 1970s, is this. Advocates of right-wing economic policies, which redistributed income from workers to the wealthy, sought to sell their agenda by exploiting social intolerance and animosity. They had considerable success with this strategy, but eventually, the extremists they thought they were using ended up ruling the party. Before I get into that, let me take on the widespread myth that Romney lost the 2012 election because he was the victim of a smear campaign, and that Democratic nastiness radicalized the GOP, paving the way for Donald Trump. If you remember the 2012 election, which I certainly do, you know that the Democrats portrayed Romney as a plutocrat whose policies could hurt ordinary Americans while enriching the wealthy, and this portrayal was completely true. In particular, Romney was a strenuous opponent of the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, which was enacted in 2010, but didn't take full effect until 2014, an especially cynical position since Obamacare was very similar to the health reform Romney himself had enacted as governor of Massachusetts. If he had won in 2012, he would almost certainly have found a way to block the ACA's rollout, which in turn would have meant blocking the large reduction in the number of Americans without health insurance after 2014. But back to the history of the GOP. For a generation after World War II, which Donald Trump recently said Joe Biden might lead us into, we were still a nation shaped by the legacy of the New Deal. Under Dwight Eisenhower, the top marginal tax rate on the highest income Americans was 91%, and roughly a third of American workers were unionized. And Republicans largely accepted that state of affairs. In a letter to his brother, Eisenhower wrote, quote, "Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear that of that party again," unquote. While there were a few conservatives who thought differently, quote, "their number is negligible and they are stupid," unquote. Beginning in the 1970s, however, the Republican Party increasingly came to be dominated by people who did want to roll back the New Deal legacy. Frontal assaults on major programs like George W. Bush's 2005 attempt to privatize Social Security and Trump's 2017 attempt to demolish the ACA generally failed and were rejected by voters. Democrats retook the House in 2018, largely because of the backlash against Trump's assaults on Obamacare. But tax rates at the top came way down, the power of unions was broken, and income inequality soared. Why didn't Republicans pay a big political price for their hard right turn? Largely because they were able to offset the unpopularity of their economic policies by harnessing the forces of religious conservatism and social illiberalism, hostility toward non-whites, LGBTQ Americans, immigrants, and more. In 2004, for example, Bush made opposition to gay marriage a central theme of his campaign, only to declare after the election that he had a mandate for the aforementioned attempt to privatize Social Security. Big money donors attempted a similar play when they poured cash into the DeSantis campaign earlier this year. It's doubtful that they shared Ron DeSantis's obsession with being anti-woke, but they thought, wrongly it seems, that he could win on social issues and then deliver tax and spending cuts. But eventually, the forces that economic conservatives were trying to use ended up using them. This wasn't something that suddenly happened with the Trump nomination. People who think that the GOP suddenly changed forgot how prevalent crazy conspiracy theories and refusal to acknowledge the legitimacy of Democratic electoral victories already were in the 1990s. The current dominance of MAGA represents a culmination of a process that has been going on for decades, and for the most part, Republican politicians who probably weren't extremists themselves went along. For a while, this may have been because MAGA was still delivering the right-wing economic goods. Bear in mind that despite all the talk of populism, Trump's main policy achievement was a big cut in corporate taxes. But non-extremist Republicans also, and increasingly, gave in out of fear for their careers and perhaps even their safety. It's to Romney's credit that he finally reached his limit, but he did so very late in the game, a game that people like him basically started. Now back to local news from the Courier. Update: one dead in Tuesday house fire. Story written by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man who was found in his burning house on Tuesday morning has died. The identity of the man hasn't been released, pending notification of family. The man's dog also perished in the fire. A passerby called 911 around 9:08 a.m. after noticing smoke coming from the story-and-a-half home at 529 Hope Avenue. When firefighters arrived, they found the house completely filled with heavy smoke and extinguished a fire inside, said Battalion Chief Troy Luck with the Waterloo Fire Rescue. They also discovered the resident and the dog inside. Both were unconscious. The cause of the blaze hasn't been determined and is under investigation by the city fire marshal. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, September 20th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.